Welcome, everyone, to episode 364 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and we have an absolutely packed episode for you today. We are going to preview the NBA finals between the Lakers and the Heat. We're going to go through what's next for the Denver Nuggets and Boston Celtics now that they are out of the playoffs. We're going to touch on some Victor Oladipo trade speculation, and we're going to discuss the Los Angeles Clippers deciding to part ways with Doc Rivers, which came out of absolutely nowhere on Monday. Before we get into all of that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today is a guy who might be sad that his team now can't hire Doc Rivers. Morton Johnson, how's it going?
Well, first of all, who's my team, Brian? Stop with that. No, it's going well. I'm a little bit, you know, PO'd at you for basically starting the episode off lying by saying that Doc Rivers firing came out of nowhere, because you and I are part of a DM group where almost immediately after the Clippers got bounced, there were some chit chatter.
There was a bit, but I think it's still, I mean, I was working yesterday when this news came out, and I can just say, of all the news I expected to drop yesterday, that was not it.
Yeah, I mean, the timing of it, absolutely, but we did hear rumblings.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
So before we get into that, Mort, we do have a special guest joining us today, Alana Tahauer. She is a contributor at Hoops Habit and also on the Bulls Outsider podcast. Alana, how are you?
I'm doing well. I mean, the Heat are four games away from a title this year, so really have no complaints on my end.
Very good. Before we jump into the finals, could you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and any work that you'd like to plug?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just Alana Tahauer, so AllanaTahauer, on Twitter and Instagram. And you can find me covering the Heat for Hoops Habit, and then also on Bulls Outsiders, hopefully back next season.
Very good. So, yeah, you're going to be busy these next couple weeks in particular, so let's jump right into the finals. Heat, Lakers, LeBron versus his old team, LeBron versus Jimmy Butler, pick a storyline. There are a million to come out of this thing. Alana, since you are a Heat expert, let's start with them. What do you think the keys are in this series for them to win?
I think first and foremost, just staying true to their identity. I don't think it's any secret that that's really what has just propelled them forward. I think the fact that they really are all about the game. I had a feeling that coming into the bubble, they would thrive, just because, you know, there really are no distractions out there. Even Butler coming into the season was saying that he's there to win. He's not there to kind of play into the narrative about him or even to really enjoy, you know, the lifestyle of South Beach. But now more so than ever, with all that taken away, you know, they're really just grinding it out. And then obviously, as long as we can kind of keep the threes falling, I think it's been proven that as long as we get hot from, you know, from downtown, we're able to kind of keep up the momentum and get some wins.
Yeah. So I think the Lakers defensively have been pretty locked in the bubble, especially in the playoffs. They've given, you know, Houston and now Denver a lot of trouble on that end. How do you expect them to, I mean, you know, they know what the Heat want to run. They know Duncan Robinson, Tyler Herro are going to be bombing away from three. How do you expect them to match up defensively?
I mean, I don't think, you know, I would be crazy to say that it's not going to be a struggle. Obviously, the Lakers are incredible, especially on defense. I think the one thing the Heat do have going for them is that the, you know, their next man up mentality is still very much ringing true. You know, there are guys who obviously have their skill sets. You already mentioned Duncan and Tyler, in terms of kind of being triple, you know, 3-point threats. But I think night in and night out, you don't really know who's going to carry, you know, the offensive load. Jimmy has obviously been great, but the last two games, he hasn't necessarily been the star that he was a little bit earlier in the playoffs. Obviously, Goran Dragic has been doing great. There's been times when even Jay Crowder has heated up, no pun intended. And so I think it's going to be a little bit hard for them to figure out who they need to put most of their effort towards, because it is such a collective group. And that's what I think is going so well for the Heat as well, that it's not just one or two guys carrying the team. It really is a group effort.
I love that point, because the Heat for the playoffs have four guys who hit over 2.5 threes per game. So there is this level of next man up, as you said, Alana, but also just the lack of the predictability of it. You can't really know who's got the hot hand. Like, Goran Dragic can easily roll off a game where he, you know, knocks down 4 or 5. Jay Crowder, even though he was just ghastly offensively against Boston, can still get hot. I mean, and we all know what Duncan Robinson can do. And I'm expecting Robinson to actually come back a little bit. Like, he's shot 40% from three in the playoffs, which is good. Don't get me wrong. 40% is always good, especially on his volume. But he's even better than that. I expect him to come out and at least have a game where he's like, hell yeah, I'm back to normal. I can stroke that three ball at 45, 46%. That's who I am. And then there are the bench guys who haven't really played a whole lot, but if you put in a Kendrick Nunn, he can make a three. Myers Leonard can make a three. Kelly Olynyk can make a three. Even Derek Jones Jr. on rare occasions is that, you know, can go into the corner and hit a three. So they have these multiple players who can come out and stretch the court. I think that's a great point. And for Jimmy specifically, that's what they need to do to optimize his game. Because if Jimmy is going to assert himself in this series, he's going to need the shooters.
And I think also, you know, going off of that point, Bam Adebayo is such a versatile big man. You know, if he needs to get in the paint, he'll get in there. But he also has the ability. I mean, Point Bam is a nickname for a reason, right? And I think that will also kind of confuse the Lakers a little bit, just in terms of maybe not being able, or not being used to, rather, defending against such a player. I think he really is unique. I think there's, among Heat Twitter, there's kind of a joke of like, Bam is one of one, and I think that really has rung truth throughout these playoffs.
It's interesting you say that, because I wrote an article here in Denmark about Bam, and I kind of looked at his player profile and compared it to a lot of other, you know, big men around the league. And I kind of noticed that if Bam gets that three-point shot, which I know that Heat Twitter is very in on coming eventually, maybe not this year, but next year maybe, because the release is good, he is literally going to be a one-of-one player, because no one would have that diverse skill set at the center position. There is not a single big man who can both handle the ball to the extent that he can, pass it, rebound, defend at a high level, and shoot. So, I mean, looking forward, Bam Adebayo might be, or at least become, the most unique center in the entire league.
Yeah, I think, you know, if I'm looking at this series, that's one of the things that gives me confidence from Miami's perspective is, you know, obviously the question when you're facing the Lakers is, how do you stop LeBron James and Anthony Davis? Well, you know, the Heat have a bunch of wings, Butler, Iggy, Crowder, that, you know, you're not going to stop LeBron James, but they're going to at least give him trouble, and they can throw different looks at him. It's like, okay, well, then what do you do against Anthony Davis? This is the problem that the Nuggets ran into. Well, the Heat have Bam Adebayo, and if you're drawing up, you know, the person who could give Anthony Davis trouble, I think it's Bam. So, I mean, I think that's a reason for optimism for the Heat. But, you know, the more I was, like, my gut instinct when I first knew that this was the matchup, you know, I thought Heat in six, because I thought, okay,
that's my prediction.
Oh, there we go. And I, you know, it's because they have a way to really slow down what the Lakers want to do. Whereas, Alana, I think you said it well. You know, the LeBron James could be on Jimmy Butler, AD could be on Bam, but, you know, the Heat then still have Goran Dragic, Tyler Hero, Duncan Robinson, Jay Crowder. They have these guys, this supporting cast, who I trust more than the Lakers. The one question I have, you know, from the Lakers' perspective is, are they going to just be able to exploit their size? Like, the Heat are really good with this four shooters and Bam look, but, you know, the Lakers have AD, and then I would assume Dwight Howard is probably going to continue starting at this point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So can they just, you know, abuse the Lakers, or can the Lakers abuse the Heat with their size?
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that I'm most concerned about. First and foremost, just stopping AD. I'm not really concerned about the Heat's offense, but defensively, interestingly enough, I'm actually not that concerned about LeBron. And this is coming from, you know, someone who has admired LeBron his entire career. So it's not to throw shade, but he does end up playing a little bit worse against the Heat. I don't know if it's just past tensions or the fact that, you know, there is kind of this underlying still storyline between him and Pat Riley. But he does not come as alive against us in the past. But AD will definitely be a problem. I think to your point too, Dwight Howard, just size-wise, I think defensively, they're definitely going to have their work cut out for them much more so than offensively.
Yeah. And
oh boy, you guys are going with the Heat. Then you're going to hate me. My God.
You're going against your boy Jimmy Butler?
No. Let me just preface this by saying I don't want to go against him. But I was asked this question at the Danish Mega podcast I did here today for TV2. And, you know, I knew the question was coming. So I spent all last night thinking about it. And ultimately, I think LeBron is just too locked into this whole chasing Michael's ghost kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That he's just not going to lose another final series, at least not right now. And I realized that Miami has the best shot out of anyone to stop the Lakers. I recognize that. And if the Heat won this series, that would be fantastic. I mean, I would gladly eat crow, but I don't know. So at the end, after they beat Denver, LeBron was asked, you know, about the finals and whatnot, and he kept saying "I" instead of "we." Like, I got it to get it done. This, you know, we got to make it. I made it to the finals. Now I got to get it done. It wasn't like, oh yeah, we as a team has got to get everything done, win it. He spoke about himself individually, and that just proves to me that he's on that damn Michael mission again. Like, he is chasing that phantasm. And I think that is ultimately going to prove a little bit too much, because LeBron, when he locked in, and he's coasted a lot in this bubble, I think he's saved some leg energy for this series, and that scares the bejesus out of me.
Hey, listen, my best friend lives in LA, and this whole time she's been rooting for the Heat because, you know, she was like, I can root for the Heat, they're in the East. And now all of a sudden we're like, absolutely not, like going head to head. She's like, screw your team, I don't like them anymore. So I, you know, I hear it all day, every day. I think that's a really good point about LeBron. I also, though, think that there's another side to that, in that he might be so wrapped up in that. And trying to carry the entire team on his back for that reason, that it could end up actually hurting him. Obviously, I don't know if that's going to happen, and it's kind of a long shot, but I did just want to mention that.
I think that's a fair point. I think, and also, I think that has been some of the storylines that we've seen brought up before, especially during final series that he's lost, right? That he's basically just been forcing the issue, trying to cement his legacy a little bit more. And I do think for LeBron, it comes down to him finding that balance. It has to be, yeah, I want to win, but I also want to chase like this legacy of Michael. Ultimately, I think it would be best for him to just lose the entire Michael aspect and just focus on the series. But whatever floats your boat, in a way. I mean, players find strange ways to motivate themselves. And if this is LeBron's, then, you know, by all means. But I do think there is definitely a level of what you just said that could factor in. He might actually lose them a game or two if he just forces the issue and doesn't think.
And I think there's the Kobe legacy to keep in mind too. I think not just for him, but for the whole team and the organization. I do think it's obviously a very special year that way. So, you know, I think that could be something to play into it. And I don't think negatively, but just kind of to play into their mindset going forward.
Yeah, the pressing point, Alana, was really good. You know, because you just don't know. You know, we've seen peak LeBron in the finals. You think back to the 2018, that game one where he had, I think it was like 51-8-8. And then, you know, you still have to rely on your supporting cast at some point. J.R. Smith makes that blunder at the end of the game, sends it to overtime. And, you know, that's what I keep coming back to. Like, the Lakers have the two best players in the series. With all due respect to Jimmy Butler, LeBron James and Anthony Davis are the two best players in this series, but how far down do you have to go to get to that third best player? Like, Miami, you could argue, has at least the next four best, next five best even. You know, who is the Lakers' third best player? Is it Danny Green? Is it Dwight Howard? Is it Kyle Kuzma? I don't know.
I think it's Dwight, right? Like, if we really have to to put a gun to our heads about it, like, I think it's Dwight.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, does that give you much confidence that you have to, like, debate who is their third best player going into this final series?
No, of course not. But I'm just saying that, you know, when we look at Dwight, I think we do forget the talent level that's there. I mean, this year he obviously found his niche playing, you know, as a bench guy coming in and basically playing unselfish basketball. But before he signed with the Wizards, you know, he was on this whole Southeast tour with the Hornets and the Hawks and all that.
Yeah.
But he was still putting up ungodly numbers. Like, so so the talent level is still there. And we saw against Denver in the final games that he was really, you know, back sort of here and there to the Dwight that we knew. And I would be shocked if that's not, at least from a talent perspective, not their third best player, because again, you bring up Danny Green as a candidate and Kyle Kuzma. Kuzma's a chucker. I don't. Right. He's just not that guy. And Green runs hot and cold, much like D. Brown back in the 90s. Like, he's either really cold or really hot. There's no in between. So yeah. I think Dwight is going to be that staple link, right?
Unfortunately, though, Danny Green is known as the Heat killer. He plays very well against us, so I don't like that. But I do think also it seems like for the Lakers, it depends kind of who their opponent is in terms of who steps up as, you know, the third and fourth best there. But I definitely think, especially to our prior point about kind of the Lakers having the size advantage, I do think Howard is definitely going to play a huge role.
Yeah, I think he's the Lakers' X factor in this series for sure. And then I honestly think Goran Dragic might be for Miami. I think, you know, going after a series where you have to face wing defenders like Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, Marcus Smart all the time. I'm not saying Danny Green, KCP, LeBron James are not great wing defenders, but I don't know how much time those guys are going to log on Dragic necessarily. I think he's probably going to get a lot of Rondo and Alex Caruso, who can be annoying, but I think Dragic is probably going to get loose in this series more than he did against Boston. And honestly, you know, I was thinking about it, like, if Avery Bradley were in the bubble, I might pick this series differently. Like, that might be the deciding factor, which sucks. And who knows? I could be super wrong. The Lakers could sweep for all I know, but I would feel more confident in the Lakers if they had Avery Bradley, just knowing that, you know, Miami's strength is their guard and wing play. And I think they can overwhelm the Lakers. I think this series ultimately comes down to who dictates the style. Can Miami's, you know, guards and wings play the Lakers' bigs off the court, or can the Lakers' bigs force Miami to go up in size? Because if so, you know, you're subbing in more Kelly Olynyk and Myers Leonard instead of, you know, some of these other guys. I think that's a big win for the Lakers. So
let's not even put a sweep out there in the universe, please. Well, those are terrible things to say.
I'm still terrified of the reaction if the Heat do win. How many bad tweets from Sixers Twitter last summer that people are going to resurface? All of the them. Like Jimmy Butler's going to Miami to retire. I thank the Lord that I did not make any of those, but I had a couple really bad ones that will definitely get resurfaced.
Well, you know what's funny?
At least you. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Lana.
No. I was just going to mention, I saw something earlier that Waiters basically, he could get a ring either way. And I was just laughing my butt off because the thought of the Heat giving him a ring, like, should we win, is just, I mean, it's a joke. If you think back to the beginning, and this is, I mean, I was on Waiters Island. I really tried. But if you think back to the beginning of this season, I mean, what did Waiters really do? He got suspended, what, it was two or three times within a few months. So I just thought that was really funny that people were kind of blowing up on, at least on Heat Twitter, about that. And I just think there's no way that Riley would be okay with that.
Oh, no. I would be shocked.
They gifted him $50 million. That's enough. He doesn't need
to. They did enough.
All right. Well, I think it's suffice it to say we are all very excited to see how this series plays out, and Game 1 will be on Wednesday. But we have to pivot to the two teams that have since gone fishing. The Denver Nuggets will start with Mort, since they just have a bunch of upcoming free agents, most notably Jeremy Grant, who, you know, I said this on Twitter the other night, for as much money as Montrezl Harrell lost in the bubble, Jeremy Grant made that much money with, it's really not even just his defense, but, I mean, he tapped into something offensively that I don't think we'd seen from him consistently in that Lakers series. And then also, of course, you know, he's having guard Kawhi Leonard, LeBron James, and he held his own on that end of the court too. So if you're Denver, I mean, clearly they're going to want to retain him. What's the price that you say, okay, this is too much, we have to walk away?
Well, first and foremost, Brian, I did notice your tweets. You've gone viral three times over the past, what, week and a half on Twitter. That's well done, sir. And not once did you link to the podcast. That's not well done, sir. In regards to Jeremy Grant, so he's so versatile, right? He can basically play the three, the four, and a bit of five. Not many players can do that. For me, it's the three-pointer that's come along, which opens him up offensively. Rebounding-wise, I'm still a little bit skeptical. Like, he's not a strong rebounder. He doesn't hit the glass a whole lot. So I wonder if you pay him $16 million a year and you pencil him in for, like, 32 minutes a night, don't you want him to be more aggressive on the glass? I think that has to be one of the key components. Like, this, in the playoffs here, he averaged 3.3 rebounds per game in over 34 minutes. And if you play the big positions, you just got to board, man. So that counts down a little bit. Now, I don't think he's going to get, you know, the $20 million that I saw some Denver fans say, which seemed completely ridiculous to me. I would probably look in the range of 14 to 15, and the walkaway point, I think, should be 15.
Hmm. Okay, so like 3 years, 45, 4 years, 60, somewhere around there.
Yeah, I wouldn't give him 4 years. I just wouldn't. And if I gave him a three-year deal, I would probably see if I could get a team option in on the third year. So this is kind of like when college guys get hot in the tournament. Mm-hmm. It's just so difficult to gauge whether or not that's sustainable play. Like, if you look at the totality of Grant's, you know, playoffs, like, he shot 40% from the field and 32 from three. That's not necessarily strong, but he did well against the Lakers. Mm-hmm. So we're building his value up from, well, part the Clippers and Lakers. Is that enough data to really say, hey, you know what, we're all in? I don't know that it is.
Yeah. Well, especially because he was a somewhat uncomfortable fit early in the year. I mean, the on-off metrics, you can't, you know, base your decision completely on that. But they were
right.
They did not reflect well on him for most of the season. So I think you're right to bring up some of the concerns. I think one of the good things working in Denver's favor here is, of course, there just aren't going to be that many teams with cap space.
Right.
And the teams that do have cap space, most of them aren't very good. I mean, the Knicks, who maybe they need a 17th power forward, I don't know. You know, Detroit, I just can't see, you know, leaving a team that made it to the Western Conference Finals for a rebuilding team like Detroit or Charlotte. Atlanta's the one really interesting possibility to me, especially if they aren't sold on John Collins. You know, there was the talk that John Collins wants a max extension and Atlanta doesn't have any interest in giving him a max extension. So that's the one possibility that I would keep my eye on, depending on, you know, maybe they have since warmed to John Collins and this is a non-issue, but I could see that fit working very well.
And also potentially worth noting is that the Hornets might not actually be in the running at all. So that's one team you might be able to move off the list, because there is some significant tension between Michael Jordan and Horace Grant, which is, you know, Jeremy Grant's uncle. There could be some friction there. I mean, we know that the NBA has a lot of soap opera drama behind the scenes. So that could be another one right there that might actually just remove the Hornets altogether as a fit.
Yeah, that's a great call. A lot of this is going to be a somewhat weird transition because the Heat aren't knocked out yet, and hopefully they'll win the title and they won't have to worry about this for a while. But they are one of the teams positioned to have cap space this offseason. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're saving up for the free agent class of 2021, which could include LeBron and Giannis and Kawhi and Paul George, among others. But do you think they might have interest in going after a guy like Jeremy Grant with just like a giant, you know, 1 year, $20 million deal?
You know, it's so interesting just in general to talk about free agency coming up, because at the end of the day, the bubble is such a strange environment that players who might be thriving in it won't necessarily, you know, be the same player outside of it, and kind of vice versa. So I don't know. It's something I've been thinking about in terms of how much, you know, to your point about sample size, you know, not only is it a few games, but it's a few games within such a structured, unique place. And so even though, you know, right now someone like Grant, like he could have such a high stock, I don't know if that would necessarily be the case if we weren't in the bubble. So that was just something I've been thinking about. But I don't know. I feel like the Heat are on, you know, this unit right now might actually be the closest team that they've ever had. And I say that with obviously almost every, I feel like every season the guys are very close and there is a brotherhood there, but the chemistry is definitely, I think, unparalleled, especially with Butler kind of taking the younger guys under his wing. And, you know, obviously UD and Iggy kind of having that veteran presence. I think, you know, the fit could be there. It seems like he is a very hard worker. It definitely seems like he's very versatile too, which a lot of the Heat players obviously are. But I'm not sure kind of how much they'd want to break up the team and how willing they would be to bring someone like him on. I just don't know, especially with the bubble circumstance.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And I'm assuming their most likely course of action, you know, I connected them as a possible Danilo Gallinari landing spot way back when as well. But, you know, they also have Goran Dragic to retain. So I'm assuming they basically just do like a 1-year balloon deal to keep him and Jay Crowder in the fold. And just basically, I mean, why not run it back at this point? You know, clearly the results have been pretty good as is. So I just wanted to float them because Miami is the one wild card lurking in free agency where, you know, not only are they a very successful team in the finals this year, but depending on where the cap falls, they could have upward of $20 million to spend. So, you know, for guys like Jeremy Grant or even Fred VanVleet, who will be coming off, you know, successful teams that probably will not want to join rebuilds, like the Heat may be their one option to kind of have the best of both worlds. But of course, the Heat also have to balance, okay, do we, you know, we have this great team now, do we add to it, sign someone to a long-term deal this offseason, or, you know, does this success make us even more attractive to a superstar free agent in 2021? Do we need to hoard our cap space accordingly? It's like a really interesting dilemma for Pat Riley either way.
Yeah, and it's a good point that you bring up with guys like Grant who, you know, they were on such great teams that went so far that I'm, to your point, they're not going to want to just start all over again with a team who's rebuilding, even if that means more money. So that is definitely something to keep into consideration, too.
Yeah. So Grant is not the Nuggets' only notable free agent. They also have Paul Millsap, Mason Plumlee, Torrey Craig. What would you do if you're the Nuggets? Which one of those guys would you prioritize other than Grant?
Well, not Mason Plumlee.
That was literally what I was going to say.
Paul Millsap, his faux pas did not endear you during the Western Conference Finals?
No. Paul Millsap, I think, is the guy, right? But I mean, we also have to be honest here. He's not good anymore. Like, yeah, he's defensively, there's something there. And he can still pass the ball, but offensively, scoring-wise at least, it's game over. He has no lift left. We saw that repeatedly during the playoffs. His shot comes and goes. It's very, very slow. He's moving around slow-footed compared to earlier, and he was never a quick player to begin with. So that salary has to go down dramatically. I mean, I saw at the start of this season, I saw some Denver fans basically go, well, maybe we can keep Paul Millsap around for 2 years, 40. Like, what? I wouldn't even give him 2 years 20 at this point. Like, this right. This has to be a significant discount. We're looking at something in the line of maybe, you know, $5-6 million a year, and that's half of that would be off of legacy alone, I think. But I do like the component of having him there. He's a good locker room guy, high character guy, very, very intelligent, and so you need to have those guys around. Again, like just look at Udonis Haslem. He barely plays, but having that guy just around the organization is such a tremendous luxury, even though I do think the Heat should just make it official and turn him into a coach as to not waste a roster spot, but that's besides the point. So Millsap is definitely on there. Torrey Craig, I'm okay either way. I think defensively there's something there, but I just don't trust the long-range jumper, and he's, 29, 30, something along those lines, so he's not going to dramatically improve all of a sudden. So I'm really not that invested in his future if I'm Denver.
Yeah, I mean, they have Kata Bates-Jupp, who we know TJ McBride is a fan of. They also have PJ Dozier in their the back end of their rotation as well. So they have guys who they could probably replace Craig with. Totally.
And Bobo.
And Bobo, yeah. And I'm totally with you on Plumlee. You know, if he's willing to come back on a minimum deal, fine.
Yeah.
But we've seen, you know, you and I have been hammering this point that, you know, you can get replacement level center value for very, very cheap. And, you know, I think one of the things the Nuggets need to be mindful of is they need to thread the needle. If they're not willing to pay the tax and they are trying to get Jeremy Grant to return, they're going to have to get pretty cheap with these other three guys. Like, I'm with you on Millsap. You know, I would hesitate to give him more than the taxpayer mid-level, which is going to be around $5 to $6 million a year.
Can I just when we're talking about the financials here, and just so I don't forget this, I've been saying on this podcast for a long time about Denver that I did not like the trade they made with Minnesota, losing Malik Beasley. Looking at how Gary Harris played this year after coming back, I think they made a mistake there. Again, I really want to compound that point. I mean, Malik Beasley, I know he'll cost something, but he has become an elite shooter. Wouldn't he, in this specific system, offensively at least, just be a far better fit, who should presumably come a lot cheaper than what Gary Harris did?
Yeah, I mean, felony drug charges.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if you want him right now.
Well, Mary Jane, right?
I think he had gun charges, too.
Weapons,
oh, he did? Okay, yes. All right. Felony well, my fault. I only saw the marijuana thing, and I was like, who cares? But if there's more than that, that definitely changes the picture.
Yeah, but I mean, to your point, that probably it's not going to help his free agent market, I can assume. So it might actually cost him some money and make him cheaper. And look, I mean, the Nuggets are ultimately in a great place, right? They have Jokic, who's phenomenal, Jamal Murray. You know, a lot of you were saying earlier, we can't know if these jumps are sustainable, but you know, in the bubble at least, Jamal Murray looked like an absolute superstar. Like, this is the Jamal Murray who 100% deserves a 5-year max. And then Michael Porter Jr. is still the high ceiling wild card. You know, John Hollinger is kind of continually hammering home the point that his medical was a big red flag and Denver isn't necessarily out of the woods yet, but I mean, he has that superstar ceiling. Like, Denver very well could have an in-house big three. You know, they were missing Will Barton throughout the entire bubble. Like, I'm not saying Will Barton would have swung that Lakers series and that Denver would be in the finals, but I think it would have been closer. I mean, Gary Harris is really the one big question mark moving forward. Is like, can he regain the mojo that he had a couple years ago, or is it just, you know, he's great on defense still, but he's just so inconsistent on offense. Like, what do you do with him?
I don't know. I mean, you hopefully try to redevelop some confidence and see if he can just become a spot-up shooter at the very least. But that's a lot of money for an undersized 3-and-D shooting guard. It's difficult because, as TJ McBride has told us when he's been on the pod, it's lower body injuries 2 years straight. That's just not easy to come back from. Like, you just lose so much rhythm. So the question really becomes, you know, how much time does Denver have on this situation? You know, he's a free agent in 2022, but they're going to have to make a call unless they just want to, like, keep him on the roster and let him expire in, you know, in 2 years. But they have to set themselves sort of deadlines to say, okay, let's see if we can get those legs working. And if not, test the market and see if there's a desperate team, like, oh, I don't know, the Knicks, who would be willing to take it. You know,
yeah,
yeah. It's a rough situation because I love Gary Harris as a player, in the sense of what he was uninjured, and I think from him as a leadership kind of guy, he's magnificent. Coincidentally, contracts aside, he would be fantastic in Miami given his personality. Mm. I think.
Mm.
I mean, the one thing working in the Nuggets' favor is if they do decide to jump ship here, I'm not saying Gary Harris is going to get them a lot in return, but he's on a contract that's not so bloated that he's completely untouchable and they'll have to unload, you know, 3 first-round picks to get off of him. Like, he's actually in that range where, salary matching-wise, it makes it pretty relatively easy for them to flip him, I would think. So if they do decide to move on, there should be options there.
Yeah.
So let's now go to the Boston Celtics. And Alana, I'm going to start with you here since you just spent a lot of time watching this team over the last 2 weeks. I mean, I think honestly the Celtics and the Nuggets are in similar situations where they have a young core locked up for a long time. So Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, you know, going nowhere. Jason Tatum is so unquestionably getting a 5-year max extension this offseason that we don't even need to ask that question. Kemba Walker's signed for a couple more years. Marcus Smart signed for 2 more years. So, like, they have most of their core in place. Alana, what do you think they need to add to get on the level of Boston or Miami and be a legit championship contender next year?
You know, I can't really figure the Celtics out. I think part of that is just because I dislike them so strongly that I haven't spent much time thinking about this for personal reasons. But it seems to me like it might just be a matter of time, in the sense of, you know, having the young guys really reach their ceiling or at least get closer to it. It seems like, you know, they're almost there. They're so close. It's just getting over that hump. I also think that they might need a little bit more veteran presence in there, whether that be, you know, to actually contribute on the floor or just kind of as someone to come in and kind of get them through, you know, any mental blocks. Because, you know, as much as I'd like to say that, you know, the Heat played such a great game against them every night, there were times when I just felt like the Celtics were like their own worst enemy. If that makes sense, you could tell that the frustration was kicking in. They were getting gassed very easily. And for a team that, you know, at least on paper is so stacked, that shouldn't have been a problem. I think, you know, as much as I dislike him, Smart definitely kept his energy up. But I think for the rest of the team, I just noticed kind of some fatigue. And I know, you know, also Tatum was struggling a little bit. So I'm wondering if they just need someone with a different mentality or more experience to come in that way.
Hmm. Yeah, I think the time point is valid. Like, I don't think, you know, Boston fans, I know there are some people out there, they're like clamoring for Brad Stevens to get fired and like blow up the team. And no, don't do that. You guys are, you have a great coach. You have a really strong young core. You don't need to make massive changes yet, I don't think. You know, and it is easy to forget that, you know, this was Tatum's 3rd year in the league, Brown's 4th year in the league. These guys are still young. They've been fixtures in the playoffs for so long that we think of them as like, oh man, they, you know, they're so experienced. It's like, no, they're 20. Jaylen Brown turns 24 in October. Jason Tatum turned 22 in March. You know, guys like Grant Williams, who played really well off the bench against the Heat, he's turning 22 in November. He's going to have a bigger role next year. This was his rookie season. As he gets more comfortable, you know, that gives them another option. Daniel Tice is going to be signed. He has a non-guaranteed season for $5 million non-guaranteed next year. Pretty sure the Celtics are picking that one up, so yep, he'll be back. You know, who knows what they get out of Romeo Langford. They have 3 first-round picks in this year's draft. They have a lot of ways to get better. But Mort, I think the question hanging over their heads is, as always, Gordon Hayward. Obviously a really tough bubble for him. He gets hurt the first game of the Philly series, hurts the ankle, misses a month. You know, just did not look right at times out there in that Miami series. He's going into the final year of his contract, $34.2 million player option that he would be certifiably insane to decline. So I think it's fair to assume that he will be back on that contract. Do you think he should be back in Boston?
I just wanted to jump in real quick for something because it just kind of struck me. I think something you said, though, in terms of they have been kind of steady at the top year after year, I almost feel like that's part of their problem in the mentality of, you know, it is the East, and, you know, it's no secret that the East is slightly weaker than the West, and so I feel like the Celtics kind of are riding this wave of, we're good enough, we're always going to be top dog, and so I feel like that actually might be part of their problem in terms of just having, you know, they do have stars lined up, it's just a matter of, like, getting them into the mentality of you're not quite good enough there. And I actually, I'm not a Hayward fan in particular. I feel like he comes in kind of with that cockiness, and I'm not trying to say that his talent doesn't back it up. Obviously, injuries aside, that is not his fault, and it's not something that you can hold against him. But he almost, I don't know, to have him kind of leading the team with that mentality, it seems like that might be a problem for them.
I actually agree with that. I agree with that. I do think it would behoove the Celtics to at least look at alternatives. Now, that said, they need, like Atlanta said, you know, in terms of the leadership and the experience level, Gordon Hayward is one of the elder statesmen on that team. So you have to gauge what is the end goal here. Are you keeping him around to be that veteran presence who will eventually step aside and let Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown become the vocal leaders? Or are you keeping him around because he used to be Brad Stevens' player at Butler? Mm-hmm. I think that I know that sounds a little bit harsh, but honestly, that has been one of the things that I've thought about for a long while right now. Like, how much is that connection a part of Hayward's continued presence on the roster? And I'm not trying to suggest he's worthy of a roster spot. Obviously, he's tremendously talented, you know, strong rebounder, tremendous passer, shooter, and he's also a great play initiator. I mean, this year alone, I would argue he was the best passer the Boston had. So it's not, you know, insignificant. It's just, does he fit with all the pieces otherwise? And I would probably try to remove him from the equation in a trade somehow, some way, to maybe make that starting lineup a little bit more balanced. Maybe find a big. And I'm not necessarily big on the traditional big men type, but I do think Boston could use someone who could really just muddy the waters inside, go get a bucket, and go grab a rebound, go get a defensive stop. I think they need a legit big man. And if Gordon Hayward is that guy who can maybe get them that, I think it would be worth exploring.
I definitely think that the Brad Stevens connection is huge. I actually worked in the Horizon League when Stevens was still with Butler, who were also a part of the Horizon League at that time. And I can tell you that he is very, he's, you know, which is not a bad thing, but he, you know, his players become like family. And I think that carries on years and years after. That's definitely something that's been on my mind too, in terms of, would he really be looked at as a great of an asset if the Stevens connection wasn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, you have to remember, when they brought him in 2017, it was just such an entirely different team. Like, Kyrie was there, you know, Hayward was coming in supposedly as, like, this number two offensive option. You still have Al Horford, you have Brown, and you had just drafted Tatum, but you don't know what you're getting out of these guys. Now, you know, Brown and Tatum have so clearly cemented themselves as the future of the Celtics and as, you know, really the number one and number two option, and then Kemba's the number three. So Hayward's just in a role that is a lot different than what he could have expected when he signed there a couple years ago. So I'm with you guys. I think, you know, that it would make sense to explore trades for him. I mean, really, just because Marcus Smart, I think, is a good enough player, and he fits so well with Kemba, Brown, and Tatum that it makes sense to have that as your starting four and then figure out what you're doing at the five, whether it's Tice or someone else. And Hayward is your one big trade chip. If they want to have Al Horford back, I'm sure the Sixers would happily take Hayward for Al Horford. But that brings us, I think, a good way to transition into the Victor Oladipo stuff, because Jared Weiss of The Athletic, in a piece, you know, basically talking about, you know, the Celtics got knocked out, but they still have a great future. They said, he mentioned that Victor Oladipo is looking to move on from the Indiana Pacers this offseason, and he noted that Indiana is still home for the Haywards. So could there be something with, you know, Hayward for Oladipo? And again, Boston has three first-round picks to grease the wheels. They have, you know, future picks that they could include as well. But would that type of deal make sense for both sides?
Yeah, that's a good question. So obviously the Pacers salary-wise would have to add something, because Oladipo is only earning $21 million a year. And if Hayward opts in, that's $34 million, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so maybe a Jeremy Lamb of sorts, that could work.
Yeah,
yeah,
or yeah, Lamb or McDermott, I think.
McDermott, yeah. Well, see, this injury thing. McDermott is a shooter. I mean that might actually becomes, you know, dealer's choice for Boston. Ultimately, we'll see. I do like the idea of it, because it does allow to maintain, for Boston at least, this idea of having, you know, multiple wings who can defend at a high level. You know, Oladipo undoubtedly is a better wing defender than Gordon Hayward, and even if he doesn't regain his touch, I just yesterday I published a Oladipo article at Forbes where I basically questioned, you know, that 17-18 season offensively at least, was that a statistical anomaly, because he hasn't really been back to that level offensively again, but defensively he should be a mainstay because he's just so clever that way. I think that would be a very, very good deal to explore, but I mean, then we got to ask that question again: would Brad Stevens even allow it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that really what it boils down to. And by the way, Brian, I'm really disappointed. You had an awesome chance to ask us, you know, should, if it was up to us, what would we choose, Brad Stevens or any player in the NBA to build around? Because apparently that's a thing that Chris Mannix still hasn't deleted.
Yeah, that tweet should live on just in infamy.
Oh boy, that was just grotesque. No, but I would love Oladipo in Boston. I think that would, yeah, I think that would make sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think there could be something there if, as you mentioned, if Brad Stevens would be willing to sign off on that type of deal. I mean, Alana, he played the Pacers in the first round, swept them pretty easily. Of course, they were missing Sabonis, who was a huge piece of that puzzle. But
mm-hmm.
What did you see from Oladipo in that series? Do you think it makes sense for the Pacers to move on? And do you have any confidence in him regaining the form, you know, his all-star form from a few years ago?
Yeah, I think he's such an interesting one because, first of all, I've never heard of anyone not liking him, and I feel like that's like very rare in this day and age, especially just across NBA Twitter. I feel like he's one of those guys that you want on your team, even playing against him. It's hard to root against him. He clearly is so dedicated. The raw talent is there. The growth has been, you know, pretty steady. He's not one of those guys that came in overhyped and then just kind of was a disappointment. Obviously, with the injury, that's going to be something he has to work through. I don't know if the Pacers are a great fit for him. I feel like he's definitely one of those guys that needs, and I hate to use this word outside of Miami, but like kind of needs a culture, right? Like he needs an identity and he needs to be bought into a specific kind of system. And I don't know what that really is for Indiana right now. I think that, you know, their playoff run alone kind of proves that point, that I'm not sure they really know who they are right now. And I think Oladipo needs to come into a team that really has that solidified. So I do, you know, I'm not surprised that he wants to move on. I do think Boston could be a good landing spot for him, obviously depending on if Hayward is involved in that trade or not. But yeah, he's definitely not someone who, there are certain free agents where you can kind of pinpoint, you know, the top maybe two or three teams that he might land on, but the world is kind of his oyster at this point.
Yeah, I mean, we had Caitlin Cooper of Indy Cornrows on a while back, I think right after they got knocked out, and, you know, she at least hinted at the possibility, you know, that Oladipo could move on after this season. You know, they can sign him to an extension. I think they offered him a 4-year, $80 million extension that he turned down. last offseason, Tony East of Forbes just had a piece go up about what they can, again, offer him an extension this offseason. Seems, based on this report, that he has no interest in taking it. I want to ask about the Miami side in particular, because that's been a common potential destination name for Oladipo in 2021. I guess he has connections to a gym down there. You know, if Giannis stays in Milwaukee, the Clippers guys stay in LA, you know, do you think the Heat would have legitimate interest in Oladipo, and how would you see him fitting with the rest of this Heat core?
I think the interest was very much there before the playoffs started. I think generally, I mean, obviously the rumor mill is great, especially in terms of NBA Twitter. There's no, you know, hands off with those kind of things. I've heard the craziest things over the years, but I do feel like generally when players are linked to Miami, there's at least like an iota of truth there. And so I do think that they were interested. I think he would be a great fit culture-wise. Like I said, I think he's a very hard worker. I think that, you know, he is the type of player that would build up his teammates. He doesn't seem like a guy who has a really big ego. I think him and Butler would be good together. I don't know, though, now if the interest would really be there, only because, like I said, I do think the Heat have it so much figured out with this current team that, you know, it would take quite a lot of moving pieces, I think, to get him there, and I don't know if it would be worth it.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if, you know, Tyler Hero's emergence in particular would make them less interested in another conventional two guard, because, like, if, you know, Tyler's not starting yet, but it's only a matter of time, I would think. So it at least has, you know, made me reconsider whether the interest would be there on both sides. But Mort, I think to your point about you know, Oladipo's next contract, and really, you know, whatever team trades for him has to be willing to offer him, you know, not a max necessarily, but they've got to be willing to, you know, sign him to his next deal. And I think that's going to really complicate trade talks, because not only do you have to give up something to get him, but then, you know, it's similar to with the Sixers and Tobias Harris last year, where it's like, okay, you don't want to overpay to get him, even though he's an all-star, but Indiana's going to want something of legitimate value in return.
Right.
Because you also know, you know, I'm probably going to have to give this guy at least a 4-year, $100 million deal. And do I feel confident in his ability meriting that type of contract? Or is he just, you know, it was that 2017-18 season a fluke?
Yeah.
Well, also the teams that are sitting and waiting for the next free agency class and trying to kind of manipulate their money that way, that's going to definitely deter them as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, boy. It's a difficult question, because I mean, look, I wouldn't give Victor Oladipo $25 million. I think he is a good, solid starter who has all-star potential, but I think the All-NBA nod was... I actually spoke to Tony East, who you referenced earlier. He and I DM'd a lot during the article that I wrote yesterday, and he basically said, go look at his numbers broken down by month. And essentially, in that 2017-2018 season, he just got extremely hot from three in the 2017 part, and in 18, he was down to 32% shooting from outside. So, you know, he fluctuates so greatly offensively to the point where I wouldn't pay $25 million. Because you add in the injury concern, you add in all the skepticism about, well, how would his body hold up long term. I think at this point, you have to, if you're a team that tries to trade for him, you have to ask yourself that question, is, you know, what is the top level realistic ceiling that I can see for him? And that's, in my eyes, not 2017-2018 season. I think it's a significant level below that. So I think you can trade for him without thinking necessarily, oh, I have to re-sign him. I think you ask Indiana what they want, and if they come out like gangbusters and say, well, we want two young players and two draft picks, like, no, that's just not, we're not going to give you that. So I think the market for Oladipo might be colder than what we anticipate.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, the more I think about the Hayward Oladipo swap, like, it seems to make sense for both teams fit-wise, as long as the Pacers are also willing to move on from Miles Turner. And, you know, Jared Weiss of The Athletic said he was possibly in the same boat, so yeah. it sounds like that's a legitimate possibility, because then you can slide Sabonis up to the 5 full-time, TJ Warren moves to the 4 full-time, Hayward at the 3, Brogdon at one of the guard positions, and then you flip Turner for a guard. And I was trying to think of possibilities there yesterday. The best I came up with was Buddy Hield.
Well, Tony East actually wanted Depot for Buddy Hield. He mentioned that specifically.
Oh. See, I would think they would be able to get more than just Buddy Hield.
I mean, look, he's been injured for not two years, but he's played a very low number of games over the past two seasons. And again, if we go back to what John Hollinger said about Michael Porter Jr., and, you know, medical is all. It is so important. And that is not a lot of data you've had on Victor Oladipo post-injury.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking more... Yeah, I mean, I guess I wonder how Fox and Depot would fit together. Defensively, they'd be interesting, but, you know, the Kings would be pretty devoid of shooting with those two, and then you also have Marvin Bagley.
It's a shame Depot isn't on OKC. They would somehow get 3 draft picks for him.
That's very true. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a storyline to monitor as we head further into the offseason. We get to, you know, draft night in particular, I think, is when we could see some fireworks with Boston, because, you know, a starting 5 in Boston of Kemba, Depot, Tatum, Brown, having Smart off the bench, like, that is interesting if Depot does, you know, regain that form, and he doesn't even necessarily need to. I mean, he wouldn't have to be that number one option. That could be kind of the setting where he rehabs his value, and then, you know, if Miami is not as interested in 2021 as expected, you know, Boston could potentially re-sign him as well. So it's not necessarily just a one-year rental. And then, again, Hayward, given his connections to Indiana and given his fit if you move Turner, like, it really does feel like this is one of those trades that makes so much sense for both sides that it's definitely not going to happen. Yeah.
That's how the league goes.
Yeah, but I'm begging you, Danny Ainge, for one time, please don't almost trade for someone. Actually, just trade for Victor Oladipo. This makes sense, I promise.
All right, so one final question on Gordon Hayward while we're here. Would it make sense for Boston to move him for bench depth? Like, maybe get, you know, split his $34 million out to 3 guys earning 10 who could come off the pine and give them some depth? Because when you look at Boston's bench, outside of Marcus Smart, who actually started 40 out of 60 games this year anyway, you know, their best bench scorer was Enes Kanter at 8 points per game. And we saw in the playoffs as well, like, I don't remember which series it was. It wasn't the Miami series. I think it was the series before. Like, Brad Wanamaker. Yeah, Brad Wanamaker let the bench score with 5.7 points per game. I think for Boston, they need to look at the depth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, off the top of my head, I can't think of a possible place that would give up like 2 or 3 pieces for Hayward. But it is, yeah, I mean, clearly Boston needs to bolster its bench. Again, that's where the draft picks this year. And also, again, like, you know, another year of seasoning for, I think, Grant Williams. It's fair to expect him to be a legit rotation piece next year. Romeo Langford is a complete wild card, but maybe something is there. I mean, I think you're right, more like you do need to feel more comfortable going beyond that top 6, especially because you're not necessarily counting on Tice to be a high-impact scorer most nights. But, yeah, I mean, it's going to be... That's definitely the big question for Boston. It's like, what do you do with Hayward? How do you... I don't think he's long for them, so how do you flip that contract to, you know, best suit your needs moving forward? But we have to go to another team in transition to wrap things up. The Los Angeles Clippers parted ways with Doc Rivers yesterday. Adrian Wojnarowski's exact phrasing was, he is out. They framed it as a mutual decision. I don't necessarily know how mutual it was based on Rivers' statement that specifically did not mention Steve Ballmer, but We'll just have to take them at their word. Alana, were you just totally caught off guard by this firing?
Oh, yeah, totally. I think as soon as the Clippers got eliminated, I actually got several people texting me being like, do you think Doc is in danger? And I was like, no way. Not only just because of his coaching, but I think, you know, he's played such a huge role in the entire, like, social justice movement that's been happening in the bubble, that not for a split second did I think anything was going to happen to him. Obviously, I understand that, you know, the Clippers getting eliminated was definitely not how people thought things were going to go, and just the way in which it happened was pretty shocking, and I understand that if it were any other coach, I might have been a little bit more open to the idea of him being let go, but no, I mean, I was completely blown away by the news.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, on one hand, you can understand it from the perspective of, yes, they blew the 3-1 lead this year, they blew the 3-1 lead in 2015, but I think, as you said, you know, you can't measure his impact on that franchise strictly on on-court results. Like, he guided them through a really tough era of the Donald Sterling fallout. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, without Doc Rivers, the Clippers don't get Kawhi Leonard and Paul George last summer. Like, they were a complete laughingstock, you know, second citizen in their own city. No one paid them a second thought. And, you know, all, this year we considered them one of the title favorites up until Game 7. Like, most people thought they were still going to win Game 7 to go on and possibly beat the Lakers. So it's a extremely bold choice from Steve Ballmer and company. You know, you can reasonably say, like, you do just look at the on-court results, and he won 3 playoff series with that team in 7 years. That's not good enough for a team with legitimate title aspirations that needs to win now, because Kawhi Leonard...
There's this camp of people, I think, that are very much like, what happens in the playoffs, like these particular playoffs, is all that matters. I've spoken to a lot of people who are kind of like, regular season doesn't matter, and past success even a year ago doesn't matter. It's all about the playoffs here and now. And I think that kind of, you know, seems to ring true in terms of decision making, not only just the Doc decision, but I think in general, as we move into this off season, I think people are very much zeroed in on the presence. And I think also probably what happened is, you know, to your point, so many people were so sure of the Clippers that when that disappointment came, it was almost even worse than the initial, just, you know, on paper disappointment. It was all the hype and all kind of the narrative leading into that.
Yeah, for sure. And it sounds like there were some philosophical differences. Johan Buva of The Athletic had a good piece out this morning, kind of what went into it. You know, it wasn't just necessarily an impulse firing, but, you know, they pointed to, like, playing Montrezl Harrell over Zubac, which I know what you would love in that second round series over Denver. There were some Clippers decision makers, right, that were like, hey, Zubac is a lot better. Why are you sticking with Harrell? So, no, there was clearly some a lot of thought that went into this decision, but where do you think the Clippers turn from here? We've heard Ty Lue and Jeff Van Gundy mentioned from multiple sources. Woj had it. Brad Turner of the LA Times had it. Buva had it too. So it seems like they are two of the front runners for now, but it's, you know, very, very early in this coaching search, of course, but who do you think would be a good fit for this Clippers team?
Probably Ty Lue, because he was an assistant under Doc for a long time, knows that system, understands player develop or player relationships. So that's probably the straightforward selection there. Jeff Van Gundy, I am not a fan of. I don't even know how long he's been out of the game. It just doesn't seem like he should be a viable replacement whatsoever. I think Ty Lue makes sense. Outside of that, I think ultimately I think the timing is a little off, because the guy I think would have been probably the best candidate for the Clippers specifically would be Billy Donovan, but he signed with Chicago, so that guy's just not available. And again, you kind of need Kawhi's blessing, because this is how you do with superstars nowadays. So it really boils down to what Kawhi wants. Maybe it's Uncle Dennis that takes it up.
That's certainly one option. Yeah, I mean, that is a fair point, that you know, I don't think the Clippers make this move without getting Kawhi and Paul George blessing, right, because they can both become free agents in a year. And, you know, I think Ty Lue, for all the reasons you mentioned, does make a lot of sense for the Clippers. I would guess it probably is his job to lose, but he was, you know, I think he's interviewing with the Sixers today. Like, he is being pursued for other positions as well. So now it may be a matter of, you know, they might want Ty Lue, but he might have some other options. And
yeah, well, the Sixers are going to go with Mike D'Antoni, right? It seems like every media outlet is kind of being pushed by a back-channeling Sixers staff, kind of readying the fan base for a D'Antoni takeover, right?
It seems that way, but that was my next question is, you know, there are still a lot of openings around the league, not just the Sixers, but Rockets, Pelicans, etc. How does Doc's firing shake that up? Like, should every team put him at the top of their board right away?
Oh, well, you mean over Jim Boylan? Yeah, probably.
Who? Over I don't know who that is.
No, so I'm sorry. it's a living egg. No, I think they should on some level. I think they really should. He's such a known commodity. He's got that relationship with players. He's won a ring. He understands camaraderie, togetherness. There is that component that for him that teams find very attractive nowadays. And I think that, that ultimately is one of the things that we as an NBA community attract ourselves to when it comes to coaches. It's not just the X's and O's. It's what you bring on a personality perspective. And, you know, we can criticize Doc for a lot of things on the court, but for his perspective of coming into an organization and getting those relationships together and building them and really trusting his players, I mean, that is a legitimate aspect of him that is attractive to everyone rather. So the Pelicans would make a lot of sense, I think, because when you look at that roster, so young, they need to get acclimated with each other also on a personal level. They need to understand, you know, the Ubuntu mentality. Well, Rivers has that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, obviously my first thing until the Sixers hire a coach is like just keeping an eye on this coaching news. And when he got fired, I mean, I've been pretty pro Ty Lue and their search, and I've been ready to be disappointed. So, you know, I think it was Mark J. Spears of The Undefeated reported both the Sixers and Pelicans reached out almost immediately after he parted ways with the Clippers. It sounds like you're right, Mort. Keith Pompey of the Philadelphia Inquirer has been the one really driving home the narrative that, like, this job was Mike D'Antoni's to lose. You know, sources were telling him he needs to absolutely bomb his interview not to get the job. Doc Rivers, you know, comes in with that championship experience, the experience of managing a lot of strong personalities in the locker room. So, you know, I think they'll at least do their due diligence there. So I did find this story when I was looking at Doc from Kevin Arnovitz of ESPN from 2018. And, you know, he gave credit to Doc for all that he did for the franchise, but also mentioned that there's kind of he said he became as prominent a character in the workplace drama as Chris Paul or Blake Griffin or any other member of the roster. As the authority in charge of managing sensitivities and arbitrating disagreements, Rivers increasingly grew entangled with the rest of the egos. So, you know, for a Sixers team that seems to already have some locker room / chemistry issues, I don't know that he's necessarily the best fit. Like, I think I would still prefer Ty Lue, but, you know, the experience that he has with, you know, a guy like Kevin Garnett should help him coach a Joel Embiid, or a Blake Griffin, a great passer like Blake Griffin, could help him coach Ben Simmons. So I could at least see the fit conceptually on the court more than I can with D'Antoni, but I'm still leaning toward Ty Lue being the best guy for the job, which is perfect now that he's probably the front runner for the Clippers job. Alana, where do you think Doc would be best? You know, he's got probably his choice of jobs. Could you see him working, say, in Houston with Harden and Westbrook?
Yeah, honestly, that's where my mind was most at. I think, you know, the fact that he kind of gets entangled with these other characters, obviously, I'm sure that wasn't written in a positive spin, but I do think there's something to be said for the fact that Doc really does stand up for his players. I think he's been vocal on several occasions, even when players are underperforming, or, you know, even if they're kind of known for less than desired personalities on the court, he definitely does, you know, stick up for his guys. And I think that's something that could fit in really well over there, as long as, you know, if the personalities match and they're not kind of going head to head against each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it would be really interesting because, I mean, we heard no off court issues between Harden and Westbrook. They seem to be on friendly terms. It's not like a Harden Chris Paul situation. Mm-hmm. So I think if he doesn't have to navigate some complicated locker room dynamics, that could make it more appealing than, you know, a Sixers job where clearly that probably isn't the case. I mean, either way, I think whichever team ends up hiring him, if it's Houston or Philly, it's a really high reward move because he does have, you know, he won a title, brought the Celtics to another NBA Finals in 2010. But it's also somewhat high risk given these locker room dynamics. And also, you know, he famously does not want to be part of a rebuild. Like he said that in 2013 when he left mm-hmm. Boston for the Clippers. The Clippers, you know, broke apart the Blake Griffin, Chris Paul, DeAndre Jordan core, but still got the most out of that team. And, like, you know, not this past season, but 2018-19 was probably his best coaching job. So more to your point, like a team like the Pelicans may actually be kind of his best fit, where they're, you know, Pelicans are rebuilding in the sense that they got rid of Anthony Davis, right. But they have a lot of young talent, and they very easily could have been a playoff team last year. Like, he might be able to get them from, you know, where they are now to consistent playoff team. And then the question becomes, you know, is he the right guy to bring them over the hump? But that is a question for later years.
Right. And by the way, since we've recorded, Fletcher Mackel, a radio host, I think, came out with a tweet where it says, I asked trusted NBA source where he thinks name coaches land. He's got the Clips for Ty Lue, Doc Rivers for Houston, Mike D'Antoni for the Philadelphia 76ers, and Jason Kidd for the Pelicans, because let's just watch the world burn. Ooh. I'm guessing.
It is 2020.
Yeah,
so.
Right? Wow.
Isn't Fletcher Mackel from New Orleans?
Yes, it seems. This is the first time I've made the Twitter acquaintance, so I had no idea. But yes, it does say that on his profile.
Wow. That would be interesting. Well, we will have a revolving door of coaching candidates to analyze at some point. But I think for now, that is a good place for us to wrap up. Alana, thank you again for joining us today. One more time, can you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and where they can find your work?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It was a blast as always. You can find me at Alana Tahauer on Twitter and Instagram. And I cover the Heat for Hoops Habit and Bulls Outsiders guest host once the Bulls make it back into NBA play.
Yeah, ever. Please do follow Alana. She will be plenty busy over the next 2 weeks. And Alana, best of luck to your Heat. I'm genuinely pulling for them, mostly to make the Sixers front office look even worse at this point.
I love that. Whatever your reason is, I will take all the fandom I can get.
Good. Okay. And in the meantime, please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined as always by Morten Jensen and by our special guest, Alana Tahauer. Have a good one, you two.
You too, Brian. Don't die.
You too.
Thank you.